we're going to do a very quick review this morning from last week's class. We did some introductory material last week, and we'll be doing exactly the same thing really this morning as we're building to our discussion, of course, with regard to the topic of marriage and divorce and remarriage, often referred to as MDR, to represent marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Today we're going to be talking about law, or at least the understanding of moral obligations from Eden to Moses. We'll have another class next week that'll be dealing with exactly that same topic. It'll be coming up again and again, actually, throughout our studies here. So kind of get used to that, trying to understand how God has revealed himself and what he has revealed about himself and what he's expected of humankind throughout the ages. So last week we went through this elaborate chart that is probably, for the sake of the video, almost incomprehensible. There, I recognize that. But again, please call me and or write, send you all the PowerPoint charts. I think Jerry's posting those on the church's website as well, so you can get this chart. But all I've done is to start off last week with a very huge overview, very high level overview of 1 Corinthians 7, where I find six different groups of people. There are those that are both Christians and married to each other, what I call married saints. So you got hopefully a blissfully happy couple, both Christians and married. The second column, though, are the unmarried. Agamos in Greek has proven to be a very weaselly kind of a word, and so we need to sort out what that represents. But particularly in that column, you can see verses 1 and following. The F is for following, so 1 and 2, 6 and 7, 17 through 24, 27, the second half, 28, and then 29 through 35 are verses that deal with them. Whoever that group is, whatever it represents, they're talked about a lot. So in each one of the columns, I've listed the verses that refer to them. Then we have widows. A mixed married couple is one's a Christian, the other is not. Virgins and parents of the virgins in a culture, of course, in which arranged marriages was extremely common. Now, I've often thought it'd be wise if we went back to that, but I'm not sure that the younger generation is going to be very happy with that. But not a thing in the world wrong, of course, with arranging marriages. It's been the order of the day for innumerable countries and cultures throughout all of history. But what we also took notice of is that there are two foundation stones, if you will, that seem to underlay everything that Paul's talking about in this chapter. It is better to marry than to burn. He devotes 9 verses to that topic. Remain in the condition in which you are called, or in the condition in which you find yourself, depending on which of those 6 columns we're talking about. Remain in that current condition. And so 27 out of 40 verses. 9, it's better to marry than to burn. 18, that you should remain in the condition in which you find yourself, has proven to be the bedrock that Paul built the structure of 1 Corinthians 7 on. This is Paul's foundation. At least, it's what he spends the great majority of his time discussing in that chapter. He built on that foundation rather than on the sand. I picked 2 verses to look at. First is actually declared to be a doctrine of demons in 1 Timothy chapter 4, first 3 verses. But the forbidding of marriage is identified by Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 4 as at least originating or being owned somehow, particularly related to demons. He describes a lot of foul qualities in the human minds that would promote these things. But, I want to emphasize, a lot of people do this, but they do it in good conscience. They believe that they found an exception in regard to marriage, divorce, and remarriage that allows them to tell huge numbers of people that they may never marry, they're going to have to be celibate the rest of their lives, and it won't be a doctrine of demons. So I mentioned that concerns me a lot. It certainly got my attention, or is prominent in my thinking, as well as the idea of commanding or promoting or encouraging divorce. In Malachi chapter 2 and verse 16, one verse out of a larger context, God declares that he hates divorce. Now, I suppose he hates all divorce. There's sin somewhere if there's a divorce going on. And so we've got to be really careful. God hates it. Now, I know God himself divorced the Jews. We'll address that. I know for sure that back in the Old Testament, when a specific group of seven nations was placed off limits and the Jews alone were forbidden to marry them, that when they went ahead and broke that command, they had to divorce those wives that had been expressly forbidden to them. Now, of course, we don't have the tribal concerns anymore, but there are people who think that you still need a command that certain people, you know, get rid of their current mate, go back to their first mate. These are big hurdles for me to get over. They don't seem to comport with God's overall view. So we spent some time thinking about the forbidding marriage thing. I pointed out that we have very rightly and ought to continue very strongly to point out that Roman Catholicism's doctrine of celibacy surely is a doctrine of demons. It's a doctrine of demons there, and we have just stridently condemned that and fought that, you know, all of our lives, and we need to continue to do so. But if that's wrong, and we do it 71 times more than they do, it at least ought to give us pause. So what I pointed out with several other charts, this is just the summary, is that when you take the total number of nuns and priests in the world and compare that to the number of divorcees that some would say must go back to their first mate, they're going to have to divorce the one they've got, go back to the first mate, or be celibate the rest of their lives, is requiring, by the most fabulously conservative estimation, 71 times more people just in the United States to be celibate the rest of their life than there are all the Catholic clergy on earth. Bear in mind, estimates range from 10% to 40% of the American population has been through a divorce. I use the 10% figure here. It could be 280 times more people in the United States, as our Catholic clergy in the world are being required to remain celibate. That's at least got to give us, you know, some room for thought. So I summarized it this way. And of course, Stone Mountain in Georgia, I've never been there, but I'd sure like to, just based on this one photograph. But, you know, that's bedrock. And Paul has four bedrock principles that I think he is recognizing. First, it's better to marry than to burn, and, if I can get my key to work, stay in the current condition are found in 1 Corinthians 7. The third, don't forbid marriage, it's a doctrine of demons, is found by Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 4. And I've added the fourth one here, though it wasn't Paul, of course, it's Malachi. But God hates divorce. So, I've got a handout for you this morning, two of them, for the camera's sake and for everybody else here. It's the one that's got the little colored book in the upper right corner. This is usually referred to as Baker's because it's published by Baker Publishing House, but it's actually called the Evangelical Dictionary of Biblical Theology. This is an extremely heavily redacted, is a word we've all learned now, thanks to the Mueller report, but it's heavily condensed for the sake of space, and also so that I could be self-serving. It's a large article. There are things he says that, you know, I would clash on. But by and large, and I mean this very honestly, of course, you know, the larger principles are the ones that I've printed right here. You'll find especially the ones that are highlighted in, you know, that light gray right there, you know, are things that I think are very significant, and we might do well just to take note. I don't know who Walter Yule is, who's the editor of the book. I did not know, still don't. Ralph H. Alexander, who wrote the article on divorce in the Evangelical Dictionary of Biblical Theology. But, for instance, he starts off with divorce in the Old Testament is first mentioned in the Mosaic Covenant, Leviticus 21, which we studied on Wednesday nights. Deuteronomy 22, we had to look at that on our Wednesday night class. And chapter 24, verses 1 through 4 of Deuteronomy, which we'll figure highly. And in our studies here, we may have a whole class just on that one verse. I'm not sure yet. But it was already occurring in Israel. By the time Moses legislated law for the Jews in Israel, divorce was common, you know, across the surface of the earth. They had as much trouble with it back then as we have now. Next one says, in highlighted in that first paragraph, these texts present legal policy whereby quick and frequent divorce is restrained and discouraged. God has always tried to restrain and discourage divorce. I've always tried to do that. Every preacher I've known, no matter where we disagree on anything, are trying to restrain and to discourage divorce. That's God's love, because he hates divorce. The first couple of lines there in the second paragraph says, the basis for divorce in Deuteronomy 24:1 is some indecency. Hebrew is ervat dabar. When the rest of the Old Testament and New Testament are examined, it appears that some indecency probably had sexual overtones, some lewd or immoral behavior, including any sexual perversion, even adultery. I think that's critically important that we recognize that. We'll come back to that when we're studying Deuteronomy 24, find out if this man is correct. Then I'll let you read the rest of the highlighting, except for just the next one in that same paragraph. Yeah, see, I got one of my parentheses off course there. But it is likewise also possible that Jesus employed the general term porneia, Greek equals, you know, what you see there, Greek lettering, porneia, in Matthew 5:32 and 19:9 to refer to the ervat dabar in Deuteronomy 24:1. Brethren, I think that's spectacularly important. And this man, whom I don't know in a theological dictionary, you know, is just noticing that. I've noticed that. My position, which we'll be developing fully in these weeks, you know, also takes notice of that. I think that's really important. So you've got that, the more full article, and then I also printed it in the church's bulletin this morning, a slightly smaller version. So, again, I'm finding in just standard denominational studies of marriage and divorce, like this one in the Baker's Theological Dictionary, concur with these ideas. And so it's not so rare or so weird to think that those four things might harmonize and be even underlying our study of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. However, I want everybody to understand this, and please make absolutely no mistake about this. I did not decide that I was going to build my doctrinal view on this, you know, controversial subject on those four things. What I did was I studied my Bible. I designed my doctrine based on what I found. Like any good architect, first I studied everything out thoroughly so I understood the breadth and depth and height, you know, the structure of what God taught on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And then, only then, did I really come to appreciate Paul's bedrock of 27 verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Oh! See, it wasn't the other way around. Now, there's been an awful lot, you know, of abuse hurled back and forth in all religious groups, and certainly among us, about the bad attitudes and evil spirits and all, you know, that people have. Brethren, I think most everybody's honest. I've met a few I think weren't, but I think most everybody is honest. They believe what they believe with absolute sincerity. And I used to believe what they believe, and I know I was sincere when I believed that. So what I'm saying is, let's just give everybody some space. We're honest Bible students trying to figure out what has proven to be a controversial topic with a vast amount of literature, and we're all at different stages of our growth in Christ. And so from the very young to the middle age to the older in Christ, we're just trying to work the problem. I've had to change my mind. My earlier years, many years, I think I kept seeing 15 or 13 last year. It was actually 23 years that I held that previous view. After 23 years, I studied it out more thoroughly, and I realized I was mistaken. I believe, brethren, that my mistake is because of that section of Scripture right there. Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 12. Those are the absolute foundation of all marriage, divorce, and remarriage problems. Hardly any other verse in the entirety of 1 Corinthians 7, you know, can hold a candle to that verse right there. It has been the terrible civil war battlefield among us and everybody else for centuries. Centuries. This is where the battle is fought. This is what the section says. The Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Now first, in the first sentence, is it lawful? Well, let's make sure we know absolutely certainly what law they're referencing there. And then in that sentence, they ask, for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all. Well, what's the question they're asking? What's the answer they're seeking? It's a test. They've got a viewpoint. They have a position. What is their position? What are they arguing for? What are they defending? And then it says, Jesus answered, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So, from the beginning. Well, what beginning? The beginning of what? Maybe we haven't quite understood in the context what Jesus was talking about in this particular beginning. Then he says, so they're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Brethren, there's just much bloodshed been spilled over that. Some say that what that means is it's impossible for man to separate it. No divorce that takes place under human law matters to God. He doesn't recognize it as a divorce. You only think you're divorced. Well, is that true? Or is it let no man separate because you can and people do and that's why it's forbidden? God's not forbidding something it's impossible to do, they say. He is restricting something that they do. God recognizes that people do divorce. He just doesn't want them to. That's why he hates it. So there's two views there. Which is it? They said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? What law are they quoting? What law is Jesus answering? What law is under discussion? Are we sure? And then it says, verse 8, he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it's not been this way. Somebody somewhere had a hard heart. Their heart was hardened. How? But most especially, toward whom? I've met a tremendous number of brethren, good friends, honest people, who seem to think there's only one possibility there. And there's not. There's at least two. And they've never even considered. In recent weeks, I've talked to a man who is a Greek scholar who taught for many years as the head of the Greek department in a college I won't name because I don't want to give him away. I will say it's not Florida College. Okay, that would be your first pick, I guess. It wasn't Florida College. But I talked to him about that. And then I called several others who were teachers also at college, university level. And I said to them, have you ever thought that that hardness of heart might be directed toward, now I'm not going to tell you now, but I gave them, you know, I filled in the blank, toward this. And then I explained what I had come to think after 23 years of holding the other view. And in both cases, these men said to me, wow, I never thought about that before. I don't know what to say to you. I'm really going to have to think about that. Well, I think they should. I think it's long overdue. I've been thinking about it for a lot of years. And for the first 23, I think I was wrong. For the next 21, I think I was right. And that's because I discovered a second possibility that the heart might be hardened toward. We're going to have to think about that, aren't we? And then finally, we've got this. From the beginning, it has not been this way. That's the second time he says from the beginning. There is some way, this way, that is under consideration in this passage. Somebody suggested a way, and Jesus is discussing it with them. And that way has never been permitted by God in the history of humankind. Whatever this way is, it has not been this way, God's way, ever. Period. Well, that's very curious. What way is that? And there's quite a range, you know, of opinion on the matter. So what I'm saying is, brethren, here it is. Here's where the millions have fought their war in each individual congregation and against their own spiritual flesh and blood, the Lord's people. It's a crime. It's a tragedy. It's an abomination. God intended for us to understand this topic. There's no excuse for all this strife. There's a truth to be known. Somebody's right. Others are wrong. Only one is right. Everybody else is wrong. God is not teaching six different ways to understand these things. Not even teaching two different ways to understand these things. God wanted us to understand one thing in that, the worst of all battleground passages, which we're not going to talk about today. We're going to have to spend a whole class on that one, and maybe two. What I'd like for you to think about is this. Twice that phrase, op our case, from the beginning, is used in Matthew 19. Twice. So, maybe we ought to go back and do what Jesus and the Pharisees he's talking to there had already done and been doing for most of their lives. Why don't we go back to the beginning? Let's do first things first. My conviction is that the reason there's so much strife and turmoil and opposition and conflict and problems, you know, over this topic is because we really don't have a very good understanding of the Old Testament like those Pharisees did. They made their mistakes with it, but they studied it a whole lot harder and greater length than we do. That's what Jesus is talking to them about. So there are presumptions and assumptions and understandings that undergird Matthew 19, and in that context, if we're not lined up with their context, their world, their understandings, what they've got to build their foundations on, then we're not very likely to understand Matthew 19. That's why we have the problems in Matthew 19. So all I'm going to do this morning now, for the next 30 minutes, 25 minutes, is I'm going to give you what I refer to as factoids. Please don't think in terms of there's some cogent and coherent argument that I'm laying out and we're going to reach a grand conclusion at the end of this lesson. We're not. I'm entitling this lesson From Eden to Moses. And all I'm saying is, let's go back and see what went on back there, how God felt about it. All of which, I think, is going to underlie Matthew 19. So eventually we'll get to Matthew 19. First, let's spend some time like they did in our Old Testament. So, I just want to lay out facts. We're going to introduce our evidence. Here's our deposition in the court of law. Number one, go back to Genesis 2, verses 18 through 25, and you will have your first ever reference, of course, to two people coming together. In verse 18, the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." So we're in the garden. There's been no sin. We're in bodies that are currently eternal. There are no other people on the planet. We're in Eden. Two people, the only two people on planet Earth, are about to meet because of what God said in verse 18. There was one of them and a problem. Now, brother, for just a minute, just not even a full minute, but just think, when you hear, "It is not good for the man to be alone," what synonyms would you use for the word alone? What did God mean? Now, I'm the preacher, so I get to spill all my pet peeves. It has been driving me crazy my whole life that people so glibly equate alone with unmarried. I hear it constantly. I've heard it in dozens and dozens of sermons. It was not good for that man to be unmarried. He really needed a wife. So God made him a wife, because it's not good for him not to have a wife. What he needed was a wife, and no man is any good without a wife. Is that true? It's not at all true. It's totally false. It's not good to be alone, brethren. And God's going to fix that problem by giving this man a woman. Now he's not alone. And then what are they going to do? What is God's first command to these people? What are they going to do? They're going to fill the earth. And nobody else needs to be alone either. Now, we saw it last week, only briefly. We'll come back to 1 Corinthians 7. What does the first verse of 1 Corinthians say? It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Didn't he say that? If it is good for a man not to touch a woman, then is it good for a man to be unmarried? Can you be single? Have you failed? Is there a flaw? Are you inadequate and incomplete? You know, is your going to heaven in jeopardy somehow because you're not married? Brethren, from the get-go, it's astonishing to me how we insert our prejudices, presumptions, and current ideas, and as if they were axiomatic truths that just cannot be, you know, questioned. He did not say it is not good for the man to be unmarried. He said it is not good for the man to be alone. This is why solitary confinement is generally considered to be the worst form of punishment you can visit on a human being. Let's not forget that. Paul said it is good to be unmarried. He recommended it as the superior and best condition you could be in at length in 1 Corinthians 7. So if you're thinking every time you go back here, unmarried is what he meant by alone, you're just dead wrong. And if that then colors your thinking unconsciously everywhere you go, you're likely to have some problems along the way. Now in 21, I'm skipping some verses. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. He took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place. The Lord fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man, brought her to the man. Man says, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, womb of man, because she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother, be joined to his wife. They shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed. Now, I just want to again caution us to think. When Jesus said in Matthew 19, from the beginning it has not been this way, was he saying, I want everything to be the way it was in Eden? If so, then take off your clothes right now. And you know that's not so. I know that's not so. In the beginning, they were in Eden. There was no sin. They weren't wearing clothing. And when he brought the two together, you know, it was great. But there's also nobody else to commit adultery with. There's nobody else, you know, to commit sin with. It's in a world that only existed for a certain period of time for two people. And we have to be careful, brethren, when we're talking about beginnings, that we don't try to impose on Jesus the concept that he's trying to impose on us, the precise circumstances in human sexuality that were going on in the garden. Because I don't want to go around naked. And I don't think you do either. So I'm just saying, be careful about these presumptions and these grand declarations that may not have much foundation back in the Old Testament. Now, let's come to Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. The man had relations with his wife, Eve. She conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I've gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. And again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. So, we have our first instance of sexual activity that gives birth to children. That's all the comment I've got, but there it is. It happened in Genesis 4 for the first time. Now, this is the first time we get this discussion about birth. Is that a sin for him to take that woman? Is there anything in the passage that condemns what they did? Or is the passage just totally neutral? It just says, this is what happened. So there's no value judgment placed on it. Is it a good thing? Well, sure, I can go back to Genesis 2. I can see that God produced this thing. I can look in Matthew 19, see Jesus endorse it. I can find Solomon throughout the Proverbs, all kinds of places. Sure, I can support my idea elsewhere that this is a perfectly wholesome, great, and good thing. But for right now, brethren, I'm just trying to introduce us. No, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense at all. I'm just trying to awaken us. Maybe it doesn't sound any better. But I'm just trying to say, try to wipe your mind of all the programming and the great and revered preachers you heard it from throughout all of your life. And let's just look at it. Here's a statement. The man had relations with his wife. Was that good or bad in this verse? Well, it doesn't say. There's no value judgment in the verse. She conceived and gave birth to Cain. Was that a great tragedy, a sin, or just neutral statement of fact? It's a neutral statement of fact. I got a man child with the help of the Lord. Statement of fact. She gave birth to brother Abel too. It's just a statement of fact. Now, why do I go to all such great lengths? Carl?
His wife, Eve. No document there. Just recognized by God. No document.
I'm sorry, Carl. I couldn't hear what you said.
Right there in verse 1, it says, with his wife, Eve. What made Eve his wife? God recognized it.
Yeah, so what?
No document from the state or anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Carl's absolutely right. So, this is what I mean. This is right. It's good. It's standard. It's wonderful. But in the passage, it's just a statement of fact. So, there's the fact. Now, I bring that up for this reason. In Genesis chapter 4, in verses 16 and 17, same chapter, a few verses later, it says this. Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch, and he built a city and called the name of the city Enoch after the name of his son. Now, is there value judgment in that? Statement of fact. Is it not also one of the great questions of the universe?
Where did she come from?
Okay. Where did she come from? Okay, does the Bible ever tell you? Not so many words. Does all, the world of infidelity love that fact? Well, yeah, that's impossible, blah, blah, blah. Now, brother, look, just everybody to truly reach out, grab hold of the pew. Okay, look, incest, what we would call it, between brothers and sisters was perfectly legal before the law of Moses. Not after, as we saw in our Wednesday night Leviticus class. But incest is the only way that earth could have been populated. That's it. I don't believe in aliens. I don't believe in spontaneous generation. I believe they got sexually active with brothers and sisters. Okay? Now, by the way, would you marry your first cousin? In our culture, how do we react to that? Well, it's just unthinkable. Okay? But, brethren, back in the day, that's just common. That is an American cultural decision. It's got nothing to do with the Bible or human history. Marrying first cousins is perfectly legal. In your Bible, but it makes us just recoil in horror. Why? Because we've been programmed to recoil in horror. Because we were raised by well-meaning, very, capable teachers. We believed what they said because we respected them. That's the only way it could happen. Now, you want to ask me about Mendelian genetics and, all the rest of things. I'm not going to get into it this morning. I'm just going to say to you, there isn't any other way around this conundrum. In the beginning, brothers and sisters married. And from the beginning, that's the way that it was. So when we go back to the beginning, do we want that? No. Why? Because there's something after the beginning in the law of Moses that says, nope, can't do that anymore. But you could prior to Moses. In the time frame before Moses, there were no Jews or Gentiles, just people. Well, there were, for 500 years because of Abraham, but prior to Abraham then, there is no distinction. There's just people. And they're all under the same law. And incest is just fine. Genesis 4:19 through 22. We're going to start with verse 20. Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. Now you see how evil that was. That's the first time anybody's done that, and that is a gross rebellion against God's law. Raise your hand if you think that. Nobody thinks that. It's a neutral statement of fact. Is there anything wrong with dwelling in a tent? Well, no. Is there anything wrong with owning livestock? No. Is there anything in that verse that would suggest there is? No. Look at verse 21. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those sinners who become rock stars. Because he played the lyre and the pipe. He was the first guy to do that. And the first guys to do these things must necessarily be evil people. They must be wrong. No, of course not. It's ridiculous. We all know that. The verbiage does not suggest any problem whatsoever. In verse 22, Zillah also gave birth to Tubal-Cain. He's the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. Any sin there? I don't see any. Then, though, let's go back to 19 now. Lamech took to himself two wives. That rascal, that bum, that hideous, evil man. One was named Ada, the other was Zillah, and sin entered into the world. That's the way it was always taught to me by the men that I loved and respected. Show me the negative connotation in verse 19. Show me the judgment that's passed. Please, somebody, show me where my most beloved teachers were right in telling me that that's a sin when it's described in the same passage with the same verbiage where tents, livestock, lyres, pipe, bronze, and iron are brought up. Tents, livestock, lyres, pipes, bronze, iron, and polygamy were all perfectly legal before Moses, weren't they? Well, you know they were. Moses didn't bring polygamy into the world. Moses didn't invent polygamy. Polygamy had been going on for a long time. Here are the polygamists in the Old Testament. In Genesis 16, verses 1 through 3, Abraham, then Abram, had two wives, and he had an unknown number of concubines. In Genesis 22, verses 20 through 24, Nahor had one wife and one concubine. In Genesis 29 and 30, the two chapters, Jacob, he's up to four wives. In Genesis 36, Esau had three. And then after Genesis, this is just in Genesis, so no Moses. No Moses in Genesis. The polygamy's everywhere in Genesis. Why? Because it wasn't wrong. It was nothing wrong. From the beginning, polygamy was not wrong. Then there's Asher, Obadiah, Joel, Ishiah, Shaharim, Caleb, Gideon, Elkanah, David, Solomon, Rehoboam, Abijah, Ahab, Jehoram, Joash, Jehoiachin, and at least one place where it says, and those with them had many wives. Polygamy was just rampant before Moses. From the beginning, before Moses, polygamy was the order of the day. As a matter of fact, Solomon holds a record, 700 wives, 300 concubines. But one of these men had 18 wives, another had 14, another had 8. That's just the way it was. So whatever your paradigms are, whatever the structures that you're putting everything in the box because of all your preconceived notions, just know this. Before Moses, that is, from the beginning until Moses, incest is fine, polygamy is fine, concubinage is fine. There's no law against this thing. Nobody is ever condemned. There's just no problem. Does that mean, then, that there was no law at all before Abraham, and so it was just a free-for-all? Well, brother, look at this in Genesis 12. Here's Abraham and Pharaoh. So now we're down in Egypt. Abram, I put Abraham, but it's Abram at the time again. Abram came near to Egypt, and he said to Sarai, and again, I'm condensing here, I know you're beautiful. The Egyptians will say this is his wife and will kill me, but let you live. Please, say you're my sister, so it may go well with me because of you and I may live. Pharaoh's officials praised her to Pharaoh. I skipped a verse, but sure enough, happened. She was taken into Pharaoh's house. 16, therefore, he treated Abram well for her sake. Gave him sheep, oxen, donkeys, servants. Man, that's a great deal. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues. The Lord struck whom? Pharaoh? What's Pharaoh got to do with God's people? Isn't Abraham just the first of the Jews? And the Egyptians, they're not God's chosen people. That the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. As Carl pointed out earlier, there's the term, wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What have you done to me?" Here's an Egyptian berating Abram. "What have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister, so I took her for my wife? Here's your wife. Take her and go." Now, who's got the higher moral standard here between Abraham and the Pharaoh of Egypt? In Genesis 12. Well, it isn't Abram. Abram's telling half-truths and making her pay the price, and then he gets upbraided by an Egyptian because your morals are too low, Abram. Your morals are too low, Abram. Why did you do this to me? So remember that. There was some kind of law going on that all of the world understood. Taking another man's wife was wrong. It was sinful before Moses and during Moses' law. Genesis 20 I like even better because, not satisfied with the first go-round, Abram decides to do this again. Okay, this time he's going to try it in southern Israel. "So God said to Abimelech in a dream, 'I know in the integrity of your heart.'" Huh. This guy is a Gentile now. Abram's got people coming along. And this Abram here, Abraham, he's not quite got the integrity of Abimelech. And God knows it. "So I kept you from sinning against me." Abimelech knew to take another man's wife was a sin. He lived a long time before Moses. "Restore the man's wife, for he's a prophet. He'll pray for you and you'll live. But if you don't restore her, you shall surely die, you and all yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning, called all his servants, told them all these things. The men were greatly frightened. The whole county's upset. The whole country's upset. What? Because they know how wrong it is. So Abimelech called Abraham and he said, "What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you that you brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me what ought not to be done." Who's got the higher moral values here? Abraham, father of the Jews, or Abimelech and Gerar? Sin they're talking about, brethren. Sin. A long, long century after centuries long time before Moses. So, taking another man's wife was wrong, and in Genesis 20 it's declared twice to be a sin before Moses' law. Moses didn't bring that into being. And during Moses' law, there was no change when Moses' law came along. Genesis 34. Shechem or Shechem, heard both pronunciations, rapes Dinah. Get into all the particulars down here. But let's just, you know, come on down to, you know, the last part here. There are several things that are said. But, you know, "They'll gather together against me and attack me," Jacob says. "I'll be destroyed, I and my household, because you went out and killed all these guys for what they did to your sister." But look what they say. Their answer is, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" Now, brethren, what's the answer to that? Where's the verse that says, well, here's why she should be treated like a harlot? Is it wrong to treat her like a harlot? Yeah. Did it offend these guys so bad they were going to go murder, you know, all the men in a whole city? capture everybody else. Well, yeah. They told a bunch of lies and committed a whole bunch of sins. And Jacob's real unhappy about it. But how do you answer the statement? Should he treat our sister as a harlot? Is there an answer to that? There's not. You should never treat anybody like a harlot. How did they know that? Where's Moses? Before Moses, harlotry is wrong, adultery is wrong, but polygamy and incest are not wrong prior to Moses. So whatever your paradigm is and how you view what Moses did for the few people who were limited to the tiny country of Israel as opposed to all the rest of the world, for all the rest of the world who went on living and procreating after Moses went up on Sinai, what laws were they under? They were under these laws in Genesis, were they not? Remember that when your paradigm gets employed in Matthew 19. From the beginning it was not so means we got to go back to the beginning. Okay, take off your clothes, commit incest, and marry your... No, we don't want that. Why? Well, yeah, some things did change, and we'll talk about those things. But before we do, let's just put the facts on the table. Those are the facts. Without criticism from God for century after century after century before Moses. From the beginning, it was this way. Okay?